Hello, folks. Welcome to Marvel Noise. I'm your host, David Price. Thank you for joining me today. You're going to hear from the guys. You're going to hear from Andrew and Kevin and Steve. They're going to talk about the Thunderbolts. Steve is also going to talk about the Amazing X-Men, the final arc for that book, and the Nightcrawler series from Chris Claremont and Todd Nauck. But that'll be in a few minutes. I just want to give a quick rundown. I don't have my notes in front of me. This is a very shambled, haphazard. It's the usual you get from me, but right now I have nothing. I have no iPad in front of me. I don't have Evernote open. So I'm just going to say that I read the first issue of the Red Wolf series. Probably would have been a bigger deal if I had finished the 1872 miniseries, the Secret Wars tie-in. But hey, I enjoyed it. I liked it, but a lot of it also reminded me of the recent Moon Girl and Devil Dinosaur first issue, where Devil shows up in modern-day New York, and that is kind of how it felt at the end of Red Wolf. So, if you didn't read Moon Girl and Devil Dinosaur, then cool. You know, this was a something unique you hadn't seen recently in the past few weeks as far as a Marvel book goes, or at least not in another Marvel book I've read. If you did read Moon Girl and Devil Dinosaur, maybe it's just me, but that's kind of sort of how it felt to me. I did read Daredevil. I think I mentioned Daredevil last time. That was it was interesting. I may not be the biggest Charles Soule fan, and Jason and I talked about the issue a little bit on this week's 11 o'clock comics. There seemed to be more questions as with each turn of the page, which is fine, but it took me out of the story somewhat because I still had questions and even more questions by the time I got to the end of the issue, just based on what was on those pages. There were plenty of questions there, but remembering what happened before Secret Wars, of course, questions kind of carried over from the Wade and Sumner. Nevertheless, Garney's art was fantastic. So I would, if you're a Daredevil fan, I would really kind of check it out just to, it is a really, really good jumping on point. And because I had questions that weren't answered, there really isn't a lot you need to know from the previous volume going into this. So that is a good thing. I guess that's a positive in that, if you weren't reading the earlier run, then there really isn't too much that kind of points back to that. I was making hand motions, which of course you didn't see. I was catching up on Star Wars because this week on 11 o'clock comics, we are going to, it's an all Star Wars themed episode. And we have all been just really hunkering down and reading everything Star Wars, the original Marvel run that the Dark Horse collected, and now that Marvel is putting back out in omnibus. We also have the various Dark Horse miniseries and or ongoing series. You've got the Knights of the Old Republic. You've got Star Wars. You've got Legacy. You've got there's this Crimson Empire. There's Darth Vader and the Lost Command. There are so many different Star Wars books that Dark Horse put out. There's the new Marvel stuff and up to the current crossover Vader Down, which is really, really good. I am enjoying all of the first arc on the Star Wars stuff. We're not really going to talk about that too much, but Eminent and Von Grawbadger are fantastic. They are, for me, they're pretty much up there with Al Williamson when it comes to Star Wars artists. There's the Lando book, which I haven't finished yet. There's also the new Chewbacca book and the Princess Leia book, which I should probably get back to. But the Star Wars stuff has just been fantastic. Darth Vader stuff, I like. I'm enjoying the drama that surrounds Darth Vader. And I like Dr. Aphra. I really enjoy the book. So that's pretty much where my mind is at the moment. So, yeah, if you want to join in and then catch up on the Star Wars stuff, we may not be spoiling too much. I don't know. I really can't say. We may. I don't know. But we will be talking about the movies. We'll probably be talking about maybe some novels, maybe some cartoons. We will be talking about all things Star Wars, and we are all going to talk about our top five Star Wars characters, not just Jedis, not just Sith, not just from the comic book, but of all, canon or non-canon, since, of course, the Dark Horse stuff is no longer canon. So that is what I'm looking forward to this week. I apologize for the lateness in this episode. That is entirely on me. I am not working tomorrow, so the day went a little longer than it usually does for a Sunday. So now we're actually in Monday. And that will do it for me this time. I'm going to let the guys do their thing. So you're going to hear about the Thunderbolts. Then you're going to hear from Steve. So that will do it. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.
Welcome back, Marvel Noise listeners. Guess what time it is? It's time for more of Marvel's Most Wanted. Yes, it's the Thunderbolt segment featuring WWX Whirlwind Kevin up in Canada.
Although I think we might be just as like lightning half the time now.
And coming, beaming directly in from the bunker, Super Steve.
And the other half of the time, we're the Thunder fans.
And coming to you from Counter-Earth, it's me, Andrew, the LA Rabbit.
Oh, that's weird. Because
for those of you that...
You know, Steve's on Battleworld, you're on Counter-Earth, I'm on the real Earth. This is getting confusing.
Which Counter-Earth? Which iteration of Counter-Earth?
Planet Doom.
Well, we're going to... Yeah, exactly. We're going to find out what's going on with our Thunderbolts, because we are, in fact, back. Hopefully, we won't take as many breaks as we have been, because I know someone out there in the world is clamoring for more Thunderbolts coverage. And the genesis of this segment was Kevin is a big Thunderbolts fan. I am relatively new to the title, so we're doing a big reread, and Steve is halfway in the middle, although he's revealed that he has never read these issues before. In the past, I came up with some sort of goofy description of the Thunderbolts, and then I remembered, hey, they put one in the caption boxes. So once they were the world's latest superhero team, but the truth was revealed, they were secretly the masters of evil. Now they have achieved the impossible redemption and an official pardon for their crimes. Is freedom the end of the story or just the beginning? Dun, dun, dun.
Oh, that's
Kevin,
only...
You want to give us our...
That's only one of them, Andrew. One of them is like former villains on the run, trying to keep a deadly weapon out of dangerous hands in order to save countless lives. Will they have to sacrifice their souls? That's the other one.
Not our souls! Not again!
But, so, Kevin, do you want to give us the team rundown?
All right. I'm not sure if this is the lineup I used from last time. Well, everyone's going to have to bear with us if I didn't write up a new one. But our Counter-Earth Bolts are Baron Zemo, who's a swordsman and a new old body. Carla is Moonstone, power of phasing and blasting. Eric and Dallas, they're Bubblegum. They're using the same body. Abe is Mach-3, who has the power of fighting, and he has an amazing armor. Norbert, the Fixer, he's the tech guy, the smart guy, the electronics guy. Haley Jolt, power of electricity, I guess, basically. And then on regular Earth, we have Melissa, Songbird, power of sound and persuasion sometimes. And Clint Hawkeye, who is an ex-Avenger, ex-Thunderbolts, ex-prisoner. he's basically on the run. We don't know, really know what's up with him yet.
And he's got a scar on his lip.
Yeah, they're still remembering to put the scar in for a while yet.
And now the Counter-Earth Thunderbolts are our Thunderbolts, but on Counter-Earth. Right? Yeah. It's not the Counter-Earth versions of them. Although Zemo has used the fact there is a Counter-Earth version of himself to get himself a new body, right?
Yes. All right. That's not confusing at all.
No, I got it straight.
Okay.
If I can do it, you can do it.
You have to come up with new ways to de-age these people to make them continually relevant.
Oh,
and that seemed like just as any a clever way.
It's like the Magneto
thing.
And it
fixes his face, right? This one never was the Phoenix and fell in the Adhesive X in that great issue of Captain America and the Falcon.
Yeah.
That was made into a Power Records audio drama. Love that one.
But you know how that works, though, Steve. It's like Nick Fury with his eye.
Or any of Nick Fury's offsprings or relatives. Yeah. I'd have protective eyewear on, like, 24-7.
Like, aren't you just waiting for, like, Zemo to be eating some soup and then someone, like, bumps the table? My face! I'm not supposed to get hot soup on it! Anyhow.
So we are smack dab in 2002. Heading into summer. We're the boys of summer. And the title, we're in the mid-60s, the title's about to split to bi-weekly. And according to everybody's favorite historical internet research Comicron source, Thunderbolts were batting sort of just out of the top 50 with sales around 30,000. So it was a going strong, but, you know, it kind of eked out of the top 50 sales. And you know, I predict that they will go strong and continue on unimpeded to the modern day.
Wow. That's incredible.
We're on issues 63 to 65 for tonight's sitting. And now the issues are alternating, where we're getting an issue of what's happening with Hawkeye on the lam and Songbird chasing them down. And then the Counter-Earth Thunderbolts in the next issue, and then back and forth and back and forth. It's going to be this same pace all the way up to 75.
Yeah, it's incredible that
the
Marvel remembers that they're publishing Thunderbolts, and they're like, yeah, we intend to publish this title for another 10 issues. Sure, go bi-weekly and everything.
Well, you guys don't have any faith. I have faith that the title will continue. But 63 finds it a striking cover of Songbird adopting her sort of screaming Mimi persona with a black and white, well, a tan and black wanted poster of Hawkeye and looking like a real bad shut your mouth character. And it's Zercher and Vey bringing it home with and Nisienz is going to be our writer on this. And Zercher does get story credit too. And I don't know if you guys noticed, but this is clearly before Joe Quesada made the big jump. He's only the chief. Because let me tell you, his cigarette smoking, not only is Melissa, but Dum Dum Dugan, Justin Hammer, like everybody in this comic smokes.
Yep. I knew someone was going to mention that. But Melissa does mention at some point that it'll kill you.
It's surprising that she would be doing it since she's a vocal character, right? Her power is through her throat, but she's got an ashtray full of cigarettes already smoked, too, and she keeps going through the whole first part of the issue.
Well, she's a method actor.
True. She's getting into it. She's chasing down those fugitives on the lam. Cottonmouth, Plant Man, Headlock, and Hawkeye.
Who's Headlock?
And
he was just made up for this.
But they know that Mentallo had taken over that idiot, so the ruse is completely up.
Yeah.
But I felt this was a little it really is actually a pretty good issue if you want to just jump on, because it's super decompressed. I mean, they take a good like 5-6 pages to kind of set the table. Yeah. When in the past, Thunderbolts was really pretty good about like, okay, we're going to jam everything into a page or two. you know, we get a long recap of sort of the status quo.
And as much as I like cheesecakey stuff in comics, I look beyond my personal bias and can, I think it's actually pretty clever how they do this whole opening sequence with giving the framing sequence of Melissa basically getting undressed and changing her clothes and smoking a lot of cigarettes along the way with the flashback sequences. And it kept me flipping the pages.
She's also drinking beer.
Yeah, I thought it was an engaging scene. It's her catching up on what's going on with them, you know? She's putting the clues together and looking at the evidence so far, and in doing so, catching us up.
Yeah. I feel like the new Marvel is sort of... It's still like classic Marvel in that it has subplots and a lot of character stuff, but like the pace has certainly changed, and you'll see with the bi-weekly that it's not cram 10 subplots into an issue pacing anymore.
And they were particularly playing with doing like a little superhero noir here. It is not as in fad as it has been in the last decade. So they just played around with it for that scene and had her being the detective, orating to herself as she's going on her mission and considering her options.
And she basically tracks Hawkeye through you thinking like a criminal type of thing. Although I didn't like that she knocked her old screaming Mimi outfit. That was a cool looking outfit.
Yeah.
Did you notice she goes to Rogue's costumes?
Yep.
Well, it's the Rogue's Gallery costume.
Yeah, I guess it's not Rogue's. It's full name. She might have went there too for her outfit, though.
We'll take Mark money. Hint, hint. It was fun to see. You know, Nisienza liked continuity and playing around with different things, and it was fun to see him setting up this little, you get a glimpse of the little network of the, you know, the B villain, and kind of how they get by, whether it's a restaurant that they go to, you know, a diner, or this costume place that helps him out. And she's, you know, following the footsteps that she would take and kind of trying to get some information by visiting her old haunts.
Yeah, if you're not going to the Tinkerer for, like, all that armored and tech, I guess you need someone to give you some kind of spandex or whatever. Some kind of other outfit.
Yeah, and alterations are expensive, so.
Yeah. And I guess after you pull off that job, maybe you can pay it off.
Aren't they all made out of unstable molecules as well, too? And, you know, finding that stuff ain't cheap.
Jeez, he needs to trademark that.
But the only thing that was left off a little bit was I'd forgotten why Plant Man was agreeing to team up with Hawkeye. Because I don't remember that sort of shift in his why he would team up with him. But I guess you just have to kind of take it as given.
He's become Huma Sapien.
I thought he was becoming more like Jason Woodrue from DC Comics, but...
The who?
I like that they have Songbird Mimi tracking the gang down to... she realizes there's a connection between all the places they've stopped, right? And it's kind of an important one.
Yeah, and we're going to a familiar place in Vancouver.
But they're all... installations and businesses that Justin Hammer owned.
Yeah, he's dead at this point in time.
So she's able to figure out where they're going to go next, or likely to. And sure enough, they're there getting mission parameters. And on the map behind them is a big red box around none other than Latveria's favorite, or sometimes not favorite, neighbor to the south, Simcaria.
Oh, we just can't get rid of Silver Sable.
Yeah, good thing we've finally done that Sable bit, because it keeps coming up.
Yeah,
it's all over the place.
You know, I actually compared this against the Marvel Atlas that came out a few years later, and it's closely the same thing. Like, it's not 100%, but it's basically the same map.
Transylvania is still that big?
Well... That's what I'm saying. It's close enough, but you know.
Well, it's at an angle, so it's distorting the screen.
Oh, that's right.
A little bit. But see, if Justin Hammer wasn't smoking, he wouldn't be dead. So. And it's the evil cigarette holder too. They're never good guys. They got the long cigarette holder.
The Red Skull cigarette holder.
Oh, the Red Skull. And when they showed a glimpse of him earlier in the issue too, and there's so much starch in his collar. That's the skull I like. But the whole deal with Songbird following Hawkeye and Hawkeye being on the lam is that Hawkeye was given a secret mission from Dum-Dum Dugan to follow these guys who were escaping and find out what their mission is and who's supplying them and what the deal for what purpose. And so Songbird is supposed to keep track on them and figure out where they are and figure out what's going on, but she's not supposed to interrupt them. They're supposed to continue to move forward so that they can reveal the next layer of the plan. So this was an important step. Okay, Simcaria, something's going on there.
But just when it's about to happen, bonjour, mes amis.
it's the
Marvel Comics Learn to Speak French.
But it's the Whirlwind knockoff.
Yeah. He's terrible. He is. With the long hair and everything, like Fabio, I just want this guy to be beaten down every time I see him. He reminds me like of a run-of-the-mill like Rob Liefeld mutant that would just pop up on one of the like bad mutant teams, you know, when there was tons of them all over the place.
Oh, come on. The guy had four arms, Steve. Four arms. Get it? Ever notice Cyclone has a letter on his chest, too?
He's spinning too fast for anyone to ever get a good look at it.
Yeah.
But he was there to, just for a little industrial espionage. He's getting a disc. It's nice that it wasn't a floppy disc. It's an actual disc.
Oh, by this point, they've moved on. They're not getting, I don't think, their Blu-ray, but they're getting at least their CDs.
He's getting a whole 700 megabytes on there.
Exactly. Well, I assume it's just like some PDF document or something, so it's not going to take up a whole lot of room anyways.
But it's all the secrets that of Justin Hammer's something.
Yeah.
So we'll find out eventually.
Wait, and Songbird's watching this thing.
AOL CDs.
Code to... You have to visit a MySpace page. So Hawkeye rigs up a bow to try to stop this Cyclone dude, and without the projectile that he comes up with, rigs, that's like a kind of a sharp twig, it doesn't even touch the bow, you know, just the string, and he's still able to fire off a good shot and nick Cyclone enough to interrupt him and tick him off quite a bit.
Yeah, and I imagine he hasn't been practicing his archery every day. Wasn't that his thing? Like, since he doesn't have superpowers, he needs to practice every day to, like, be in the, like, top form?
To put together a bow on the fly with some scraps laying there and fire off something without it even resting against the arm of the bow. I mean, that's pretty impressive.
It is. I don't know. Maybe Songbird was helping him out, right?
I mean, why not just throw the thing?
What is he using for the string too? Like, just what's like a twig? Like the I can get there's a piece of wood around, you know, the tree blew up, but I just don't know what he's using for.
But there's like all these pieces of shrapnel and metal and glass all around him. He could like chuck like four or five of them by the time he put together, you know. So the first shot wasn't that good. Well, maybe five, six, or seven would have hit by the time he's stringing this bow together.
Steve, no one has hit Cyclone.
Not like that. Yeah, it made him break his French and everything.
His arm doesn't look in good shape. It looks like there's like blood running down it or something.
Oh, everyone's arm is hurt.
Yeah. And then he goes for the disc that he had dropped, and then, oh no, there's some kind of sound cage around it.
You know who that is.
That would be Songbird. And everyone had passed out by that point.
And then it... Yeah, fades to black. And then it's Hawkeye looking like some character at a G.I. Joe or something. All bandaged up. And They've bottled up the hammer guys and the other baddies, except for Plant Man.
Well, they don't know what Plant Man's going to be used for in this scheme, so they're like, we better keep this guy around.
Why? Yeah, I just don't know why Plant Man is interested in bothering with this. Like, what does he suddenly change away? But Melissa did get the AOL disc, so
yeah,
no free 1,000 hours for him.
I'm pretty sure Plant Man goes free if this
yeah
turns out the right way.
And I don't think Plant Man's entirely evil. Like he's also, isn't he sort of like with the green? So.
Mm-hmm. Again, Jason Woodrow seems to be.
But yeah, anyways, it looks like we're getting our Thunderbolts back together here, because apparently Melissa's been carrying around this heavy backpack with her this whole time that has all of Hawkeye's like archery gear and his Thunderbolts gear too for his whole outfit.
Hope it has a razor.
Yeah.
He can get rid of that Captain America on Zola land beard he's got going.
Look like
he can just use a piece of wood, Steve, and fashion a bow out of it and shoot the wood so he shaves with an air, bow and arrow.
He'll just get a rock, attach it to a piece of wood, and he'll be able to shave the beard right off.
You could shave the beard by the snap of the string if you put it too close, your cheek too close, when you let it go.
It could burn it off.
Right, exactly.
But we have a prologue, or an epilogue. Not sure. It says it's a prologue, but it's at the end of the book. So, and it's our Counter-Earth Thunderbolts.
Yeah.
And they meet the new capital of Counter-Earth.
Well,
Have you guys read a lot of this Counter-Earth stuff prior to this?
I did. Around this time, I bought the whole, all that event. So, yeah.
I tried. I think I bought most of it, if not all of it, but I all I could do was kind of skim through it because it was a hot mess.
Well, there were different writers involved too.
Yeah.
Like Peter David wrote one thing, and then did Warren Ellis there was write not, part of it? Maybe
there wasn't a good reading order. It wasn't cohesive, and it was lame. I thought it was lame.
It was another Doctor Doom trying to save the world.
Yeah, and it was all disaster. I mean, it really reminds me of like what they did with like the Ultimate Universe with all the disasters and things, and it reminds me of just too many different other storylines. Doom saving everybody.
Yeah, but Baron Zemo's leading like the Thunderbolts to their new headquarters here. And it's like,
yeah, and that's why they're calling it. That's why they're calling it the capital of count. They're gonna take over Counter Earth, so they're calling their new headquarters the new capital of Counter Earth. And where is it? It's the Great Refuge.
Oh.
It's Attilan.
Attilan.
Attila the Land.
Yeah.
And you can tell because it's got Black Bolt's. It's got his little fork thing over. One of the little temple, or maybe that's the like sports arena,
the tuning fork.
Well, they also have kind of the same thing at the gates of it too. Has a little tuning fork over the top, kind of.
Yeah, it's wide.
So it's a kind of...
Was that there before, or did he like institute those things be built?
Well, it doesn't look super Kirby-esque, so I'm gonna say it's a modern twist. That gets us to the end of. 63, and they actually put the rap sheets back, the pages back, so they can explain what's going on, have some shill write in about the Citizen V series.
Yeah, and they said Citizen V's not getting a monthly. And we're like, oh. And it's also funny, they have a letter from someone from France in here. And then I'm the whole time I'm thinking of Cyclone and what this reader thinks of of the French character in the book that they're reading.
Well, they even tease Fabian saying that we're happy we have any French readers left at all, given the way that Fabe writes Cyclone. That's throwing him under the bus, man.
Oh,
well, it's not the he's not the most developed character. I think we can safely say that no one's holding out the torch for this. What is this? The third version of Cyclone? The third version of the fourth-rate Whirlwind knockoff? Who himself is a quality character. So that gets us to 64. Now, this one has a very sharp Zercher and Vey using some fancy computer stuff, but not to too much of a disadvantage.
You know,
I didn't need the flare on and everything, but I thought it looked really good at Zemo in his classic purple staring out over a crowd.
Isn't it weird, though? Like, you usually, like, would be, like, normally Songbird or Moonstone from behind, but this time you're getting, like, the shot of Zemo from behind, like, all flexing and everything?
Yeah, it's odd.
Yes, you're right. We should have his pecs and his glutes.
But it's a little bit Samson, you know,
yeah,
with the taking the columns down type of scene going on.
But very expressive mask. And so our crew moves on, and it cuts to this counter-Earth bolts. But it's from Zemo's perspective, so he has the thought balloons, which aren't thought balloons anymore. They're thought captions, because thought balloons are, you know, they're not cool anymore.
But yeah, we're going to have to go back two weeks, since I think we're going to need more background on why Zemo was leading the bolts.
And it picks up right where he had left off, where he pops out of the minivan with the new body, wearing that kooky armor, and explaining, like, what's going on. And this is where he's like, you know, hey, we're all in this together. Like, let's do this. And then some people are like, we don't trust you. And he's like, well, I can earn your trust. And Zemo seems a little weird. But he gives his backstory. Like, he left some of his mustache twirling behind. But I do like in the flashback, they use a lot of tone, which always makes me giggle on his old outfit.
So you're saying the Citizen V thing was, like, a positive experience for him and, like, mellowed him out?
Yeah, because he used to be, real, like, a bad guy's bad, you know what I mean? Like, kick a puppy across the street to kick a dog or whatever. Like, he was not a nice guy at all.
Well, he adopted some Jewish kids at one point.
Pretty jolly.
And turned them into doughboys. I think he's been so used to playing possum. You know, he's been having to shift around in different bodies and suppress his true nature. I think it just comes naturally to sort of be in that role right now. There's a benefit to that. Even he admits that once he gets them to trust him, he doesn't necessarily know what his next move is. He's just going to go with the getting them to trust him bit and then take it from there.
Yeah, things, it looks like that's what the Thunderbolts did. Like, they don't really know what to do either. So they're like, I might as well just follow Zemo. Like, what are we going to do?
Instinct kicks in. They're all followers. None of them are leaders.
True.
They're like, is there a warm bed? Is there meals involved?
Where's the movie theater?
Exactly. I don't know what kind of movies they're getting on Counter-Earth, though. Maybe a lot of disaster flicks.
I love the page where they're exploring around, and we know from current continuity and even back from the John Byrne run on Fantastic Four when they first did it, that Atalan can fly, right? That it moves. So there's a great scene of the Fixer kind of looking around trying to figure out some of the anti-gravity generator mechanisms, and Mach, I want to say the Beetle, but Mach, whatever he is, 7,
three.
14, 3.
Three.
Mach 3 asks him if he can get these, you know, anti-gravity generators to work. And he's like, as if there's any kind of tech I can't figure out. And in the same exact panel that just has slight differences to show that it's further off in time, he's like, I can't figure these things out. And I like that they didn't do that with a page turn. Instead, they did it with just subsequent panels next to each other. The pacing was nice on that.
But apparently... Oh, yeah. I was going to say, and then Zemo figures it out just with a switch on a wall. But I think we better go back and cover some of these character moments before we get to the roaring of the place coming to life. All those, like, things you might have forgot about, going all the way back to, like, Thunderbolts number 12 when Atlas saves Zemo. Like, that's a That's pretty far back.
Yeah, but now he's Bubblegum Man, and he's
yeah
man slash Bubblegum Woman. So he doesn't, I don't affect him no more. Because Dallas Reardon, she don't play.
And then Zemo's just like, ugh, man, I gotta figure some other way to manipulate these people.
But he's pretty, like, it's weird that he's out of outfit the whole time. But once they get the city floating, they're going to go to Tokyo, which is a no-go zone, and figure out the cosmic energies to fix it.
Of course, I was thinking of, like, Akira, and, like, you see an energy bubble in Tokyo, and I'm just... That's where my head goes.
Because Counter-Earth is still suffering from these geotropic and radioactive disasters, natural disasters, because this planet needs to be healed, right?
That's their whole mission.
And who better than the Thunderbolts? Mm. So they're running around trying to rescue people. There's a cool character that might come back who's got some weird superpower that's able, it's like Eunice the Untouchable, but he can broadcast his field. When they go to rescue him, he's like, I can't leave my parents. His parents are dead.
That wasn't so creepy at all.
He pushes them away. Very Walking Dead, I thought.
And I like their mission, too, is a rescue mission. And since they've got the floating Atalan, they fly Atalan over there and load it up. It's a city. Well, the city can handle people. So they grab 4,000 refugees from the city.
I think they're sheep. That's what Zemo calls them, Steve. Sheep.
An excellent use of the word bleeding. Not bleeding, but bleeding. he calls them, he says they're bleeding and hungry. Google it.
Hmm.
And, this looking over the masses, being their savior, it's slowing Zemo down a little bit and making him bask in it some. Like, this is also ego supportive, you know? Maybe there's something to this. This is something my father would never consider.
Yeah, he always compares himself against his father, and it's like, my father could never accomplish, or I can always best my father or do something that he couldn't do, or it's a challenge, like...
But doing something like healing, saving a planet, that's beyond anything his father would ever think of.
Yeah.
Or even attempt, and here he has a possibility of doing it. So he's starting to put his eggs in that basket.
Also, like, all his poses are like hands on hip, arms crossed, hands behind his back. Like, he's always very, you know, got that Doctor Doom vibe going on about. He was never just slouching around or whatever.
Zerker likes to draw hands like Bagley liked to draw feet. Anything to hide those hands.
And we also have a special guest appearance by Chef Boyardee. Oh, wait, no, that's an advertisement. And we do have a little bit. They haven't completely abandoned us with the fun subplots. We get a look for the Cardinal and the Crimson Cowl and Meteorite and this whole mix-up of pulling that storyline back. If you remember when the Graviton attack, and somehow, I don't know how she's able to convince him that Hawkeye is the one. I guess because he put her in the pro... I don't know. It seems pretty thin. Basically, she wants him to join the group so that he can get revenge for the death of his daughter.
Well, it's not...
By joining...
Yeah, I don't know if you call Cardinal and some of these villains the smartest guys anyways, but... Yeah, she sort of twists around a little bit and keeps on mentioning things, and he's like, yeah, okay, fine.
So he's going to join the Bachelors of Evil... Which this incarnation has a Hydro Man who's also smoking. Seems like a weird combo. Like, out of all the characters to pick, like, the dude that's made of water, it seems unusual. And then the one I think that doesn't belong is Machine Smith. Like, he is way too powerful for this group of scrubs. Like, he's a real... He can you know, with his ability to jump his consciousness into machines and everything. I think he is far and away the most powerful.
He's the fixer of the group.
Yep.
And then also the Call of Duty again gets another promotion. Did you guys ever read the Call of Duty?
I thought you were referring to the video game. You mean the 9/11 firefighters comics? No.
Yeah. This is they had also a little promo, I believe, in the Citizen V series. So this is a separate one. It feels like I'm really getting into David Finch pencils.
Yeah. So how familiar are you with some of these? Like, we know who Mankiller is. Like, she was...
Well, I love Machine Smith. He's great. Yeah. Hydro Man's an old Spidey villain. He's also cool. He was one of the Sinister Six, or what, the Sinister 12, or Sinister 24, or
Sinister Syndicate?
Sinister 48, Sinister Syndicate. I assume they have some reject from the Serpent Society. I don't remember which one she is.
Okay.
The Gypsy Moth is from the Spider-Woman.
Yeah, that's right. That's a deep dive.
Yeah.
I was going to say Iron Man, but that's because the Heckle and Jekyll brothers, the two brothers Grimm, crossed over both those titles too.
That Spider-Woman title, towards the end of its title, like, I think it ended with issue 50, if I'm not mistaken, but like the march up to that issue was really good. Brian Postman was the artist at the time, and I think Steve Mitchell inked it. If not, it's someone who was pretty heavy-handed, like a Steve Mitchell. But Postman's art was really good on that book, and that was fun. The Werewolf by Night was involved, and Gypsy Moth, and interesting.
I think I've only read a few issues. Like, I read the first one, and I also think I read like one with like maybe Siren or.
Yeah, right. With Hydra. That Steve Lealoha drew. And the finale issue also had a photo cover that had a Marvel staffer dressed up in the Spider-Woman outfit and all the guys. Yeah, pretty cool.
At one point, I think I'd collected that entire series at some point back in the day.
Wow.
I really liked, I mean, not, when did it end? Like, whatever the part from the 80s were.
Yeah.
Or was it the 70s?
It started in the 70s and ended in the 80s.
Yeah. I had the whole series almost at one point. I really dug that. I thought it was a very good series, but I don't know, since it's long been given away to the lost of the ages, but I dug it. I thought that was a strong title.
Yeah, they put out the whole series out in Essentials, and now they're masterworking it.
Yep. I tell you, though, those last bunch of issues, if you're ever bargain bin diving, good stuff. Brian Postman.
The Crimson Cowl here needs to capture Plant Man. And apparently next issue we're getting the new Thunderbolts before the real new Thunderbolts title launches.
Okay.
No, it's just, I noticed they use new Thunderbolts, and I'm like, I guess I never realized when they, you know, when they switched the title that they had first used it here, but.
The nude Thunderbolts? I just don't want to see that.
Oh, jeez. Oh. Well, there's only, you want to see Plant Man? You want to see Plant Man and Hawkeye naked? All right, okay. That's what you want to see.
No, thank you. The art in this next issue, though, was really strong. I don't know if it's because of the biweekly shipping that was going to start right after this. They were already benefiting from having more time or whatever. But, man, some of the figure work and noodling on the faces and stuff just to make people convey some attitude. They really spent some time on some of these panels and splashes.
Or is that because there's two inkers?
Maybe.
Well, the cover is Hawkeye, but it's a Zercher and Jose Marzan, I'm going to guess. It's not Bay.
Okay.
Just signed Jose, so I'm guessing that's who the inker was for it. But it's Alve and Nelson inks on the inside. But again, the Nissan's a Zercher. And I'm wondering if maybe Zercher was doing breakdowns because for both issues, and then the inkers were taken over a bit more or whatever.
I don't know, but that splash page of Hawkeye, look at his face. It looks great.
Yeah. Hey, we got a new Thunderbolts logo, too.
Yeah, I don't care for the patterning But the font is neat.
Yeah. Yeah, the pattern is
like the lightning bolt T.
It's like purple splattered. It's like Donny Osmond's socks after he stepped in a puddle.
Oh, purple for Hawkeye. Who's I like that he's in his purple, his real outfit, not this movie nonsense garbage. And he's got his Thunderbolts belt buckle, looking like he's just out of the Texas rodeo. The only thing I don't like is we're right into modern storytelling where it's like we're going to show a bunch of nonsense and then flashback to how we got there.
Mm-hmm. And the whole issue is Hawkeye describing or telling us about stuff, and it turns out that it's he's writing a letter to someone.
Well, we all can't be as nice, but it gives his old background a little bit.
Yeah.
Real quick, from, you know, when he was the bad guy, to join the Avengers, to leading the Avengers, to this, to going to prison, and get all scar. That.
Scar on the lip. That gets its own chapter.
Yeah, and a sweet double-page Tang spread. But basically, the three of them are chasing down Cyclone. It's going to be kind of embarrassing that the Songbird, Plant Man, and Hawkeye can't catch Cyclone. Like, that's not good.
But that's like catching the wind. You can't catch the wind. You can't hold it in your hand.
No.
Yeah.
You can't hold me. Well, they make some reference to, oh, we hate the wind, or there's some comments about the wind. I'm like, hey, wait a second here. This is almost... No, they're showing Cyclone some respect, I guess.
Oh, he's such a jerk. If anyone could touch him, he would have been beaten down so many times so long ago. You gotta be evasive with that attitude.
Apparently, he does a touristy thing, too, because it's funny that he hits, like, all these museums and all this stuff along the way.
He's got time.
Yeah.
But they try it. Melissa puts the whammy on him. But just as he breaks out, it's the old mold in the mouth trick.
Oh, this guy allergic?
Nope.
Oh, good. Then he will live.
Yeah.
And then Cyclone like flips super easy for as tough as it was to capture him. Yeah, once you capture him.
Yeah, once you got mold in your mouth.
He is done. And he also mercifully drops a lot of the Batroc the Leaper talk, too.
Oh, like it's because of
the... actually...
the letter last issue. You know, you also see a Justin Hammer popsicle this issue, too.
And so they go to the head base.
Is he, like, in the negative zone or something?
Justin no, I think Hammer. It's supposed to be outer space.
Okay.
Because this happens in Iron Man, the Bad Blood series. I think Busick didn't cover up everything, like all his plot threads from the series. So it's Leighton and who was it that came in to finish it up, and then Hammer turns into a popsicle at the end of that book. But it kind of looks like, yeah, it could be like some weird dimension where he's just like, help me.
Well, you know, it's all that. Again, he every time you see him, he's got that the evil Red Skull cigarette thing going on. But it's my favorite Whiplash. Again, a pox on that movie nonsense. That's the real guy with the big top knot and the purple cape.
Oh, yeah.
That's my Whiplash.
And one whip.
One whip? Not two whips?
Well, he's got his buddy Blizzard. I was like when they all teamed up and beat on Iron Man.
I love that old Blizzard costume, too. That was cool.
But they decide instead of knocking on the door, they're going to tunnel through.
Yeah.
With Melissa with the jackhammer sound effect. And Plant Man using his plants.
Yeah,
but right when they come out into the conservatory with the candlestick, it's a trap.
I got Admiral Akbar.
Yeah, I don't see any Star Wars stuff here, Steve.
Nope, but it's still a trap.
Yeah.
Is that dude Crossfire in the armor? What's that idiot's
Cardinal
name?
From the New Warriors?
Oh, that's the guy. So that's what Cardinal looks like.
Yeah, because his daughter was killed on the Redeemer's team. Jeez, you need to read more New Warriors.
Couldn't that plant over there in the corner have warned them?
Oh.
Warn the plant man?
Well, didn't he say it was hard to break through the surface anyways because he couldn't see that many roots? So yeah. Maybe he didn't realize the plant was there. Unless it's a fake... No, it's... Steve, it's probably a fake it's plant. A
fake. That's not a FICA. That's a...
FICA.
Fake a FICA. Oh, my God.
Mankiller looks really, really smiley here and only too happy to just bust up the floor and, like, murder them.
I know.
Well, you know she had that little thing going with Eric, and Eric's gone, so...
Any opportunity.
That was the only thing stopping her.
Yeah, and then we see some of the... Like, if you didn't know what Gypsy Moth's powers are, she manipulates fabrics and everything, so... She gets a drop on Melissa.
Everyone gets the drop on these Thunderbolt, this small team of Thunderbolts here, because Hawkeye isn't used to being in a firefight with a team again, and even though he invokes Captain America's name, he gives the wrong advice, and it leads to them being taken down pretty quick.
See, I told you, Steve, when I was concerned about his archery, I was he hasn't been practicing. He's out of touch. Like, he needs to keep his mind sharp.
If you don't use it,
definitely
out
of practice.
And they kidnap Smithers. I always think of The Simpsons whenever he's mentioned. But the Plant Man. And
come, Smithers.
They leave dead Hawkeye buried under rubble. And Songbird there. An escape on the Flying Wedge, which is not the Flying V, but looks similar to it.
Wonder if you can go inside of it.
But, guess what? Hawkeye's not dead.
Yay.
Well, that's good. But you know who might be dead? Plant Man. He's not looking so hot.
Yeah, a machine smith is torturing him.
They're pulling roots out of him like Magneto's pulling Wolverine's adamantium out of his body, you know?
But what's funny about these two characters interacting, it's like they're, both of them, like, they're not, it's like two non-humans, like, discussing stuff with each other. It's like, well, you know, it's just weird.
Machine Smith looks like Jocasta with big eyebrows.
Yeah, he is really gone. He's not faking anybody with a faux human. But he notes that Plant Man's undergone radical changes.
He gave himself a big cup, too, Machine Smith.
Yeah.
To protect his mechanical junk.
And I think this subchapter is called The Autopsy. This is where we find out that Alec... Oh, wait. Sorry, I don't know how I could get confused like that. But we find out that they need Plant Man to activate the weapon because he's the only one that can.
The and Justin then that Hammer was the weapon. Clue. That's what this was all about?
Right. Yeah.
Oh. Justin Hammer's clue last will and testament.
To bust out Hawkeye and Songbird, who graciously allowed Plant Man to get tortured so they could find out what the information was. Remind me never to volunteer to work with those two. And they ambush them with they blow apart Machine Smith and send a sonic arrow.
And I think they got Neil Adams to come in and just draw that one face of Cyclone there saying, you set us up. Is that a Neil Adams mouth or what?
I think so, because he wrote a letter that appeared in this issue. So I can totally feel that maybe he did a little art duties as well. But the sonic pitch doesn't work on Cardinal. Well, I guess it's some cross between Angel and Iron Man or something. It's got those kind of metallic wings.
Yeah. It's like an armored up Falcon.
But at that point, they mentioned that Hawkeye's like, you need to wait a second. Because guess what? We found all the data from Justin Hammer, and you're going to want to know that he planted a bomb inside of all of you.
Oh!
And, you know,
so is that what Techno was seeing in Mankiller, like, what was that, 20, 30 issues ago? Wow, I'd totally forgotten about that subplot.
So every villain who ever worked for Justin Hammer had an implant.
Wow, that's a lot of guys.
Yep.
And if the technology to control it goes to the Crimson Cowl, then they won't be getting any free movies anymore if they join the team.
Oh, that sucks.
Yeah, they're really upping the rivalry and everything with the Crimson Cowl. Like, she's a major player in Thunderbolts land.
Her and Graviton are their number one villains, I'd have to say. And Zemo.
But that explains maybe why Plant Man was more interested in helping them, although I'm not sure it would work in Plant Man because he's so much plant material now.
He's not 40% plant. The rest of
these guys are in trouble, so Man Killer, Gypsy Moth, and Cardinal agree to join. But there's one guy who won't do it.
Oh, it's gotta be Cyclone.
And so the best way to convince someone is to threaten their life, we've all learned.
Yeah, especially if you need them to decide now. I'm going to shoot an arrow at your face.
Oh, well, Hawkeye needs a new Thunderbolts.
And Songbird stops it.
He knew she'd stop it, though, right?
Oh. Sure.
Well, you get a nice shot of that scar.
That's never going away.
No, never.
And then the last few pages, you know, it's that writing the letter again, talking about how, you know, summing up the team just like the old days, except we don't have, like, the crybaby and the useless dude and all the other stuff. We have a new team.
Wait, this is his new team of Thunderbolts?
Yeah.
Man-Killer, Gypsy Moth, Plant Man, the Cardinal, and Cyclone?
Yeah.
At least there's Songbird.
Yeah. Well, they're going to all have to wear new costumes, too, because, yeah, they're going to kind of stick out. And if Hawkeye wants to scam the Masters of Evil and scam anyone else, they're going to have to, you know, they're going to have to fit into other places and do other stuff. So they're all getting new code names and costumes. Pretty sweet.
I can't wait to read the even numbers or the odd number issues coming up. Whichever ones follow this subplot.
Although, don't forget, they've Machine Smith escaped. So...
Well, it looks like, didn't it look like he was tapping into some electrical outlet and he had transferred his body somewhere else or done something? Yeah. Like, yeah. Alerted the cowl?
Yeah,
that's what I assume we're to read, is that he jumped ship and left. Although, he wouldn't have known that the other team was going to team up with Hawkeye, though.
Yeah.
Because he left before Hawkeye's big speech.
Yeah, but would he have joined the team anyways? I'm thinking no.
I don't think they could have put anything inside of him.
Yeah.
Well, if they did, it's gone now because he just blew himself up, got all blowed up.
Yeah, that's an easy out.
And like I said on the letters page, Neil Adams wrote a letter, which is pretty badass.
Oh, yeah.
Wait a minute. Speaking of letters, who was he writing the letter to?
Marvel.
Who was Hawkeye writing the letter to, Wall?
Carla, and then he burns it.
What?
Because he thinks the Thunderbolts is dead. It's like that classic Claremont burn thing where the X-Men died at in the volcano.
Yep.
And then you have two teams, and no one, and each other doesn't know that the other one's alive.
Yep, Beast and Jean Grey are trudging across the tundra.
Yeah.
And then they go and they get Alex and Lorna and... They get the whole little B team going there on Muir Island.
Oh, that was so good.
And they bring Angel and Iceman back. That was cool.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, the rest of the gang was in the Savage Land. Good stuff. So, yeah, Neil Adams.
Neil M. Adams. Uh-oh. Oh,
Madams. Neil Madams. Well, that face still looked like a Neil Adams face. So, yeah, we've got the upcoming issues are... Odd Issues going to be following the Counter-Earth stuff and the Even Issues, or vice versa, following the people on Earth, following this new bunch of Thunderbolts, and it all collides in the conclusion issue number 75, which now I'm really eager to get to. So let's read this stuff, guys.
Yeah, and it seems it's moving at a faster pace now, too. I just wonder if someone picked, like, if they couldn't afford... Like, to buy a biweekly Thunderbolts, if they just picked one track, like, which one they would have picked, or, you know.
I know I would have waited till they were all out and then read each one as a chunk.
Well, this is 2002, so you could probably, like, I think that was the era if you thought the stuff was getting decompressed to chunk it.
I do like my chunks.
Yes.
So was there a 2002 Kevin comment regarding these issues at all?
Sadly to say, guys, he was recapping the issues, but he wasn't adding comments to the website anymore.
Okay.
Whoa.
Yeah, so, like, I, at one point he goes on a calendar and starts, like, giving issues, like, a 7 out of 10 or whatever on his calendar, like, when we get further along, but...
Maybe he's reading these issues as a chunk, and then he'll say something at the end. Maybe we can pretend he said something and put words in his mouth.
Well, I remember him commenting to someone about, oh, yeah, I'm not sure about... Like, he's not entirely sure about the... About the pacing.
Oh, and, that's his alcohol problem talking.
I think the decompression thing is starting to get, is going to get to his brain, because it's 2002. Like the new Marvel's been ingrained for at least a year, probably now at least. So he's seeing some changes, and he's wondering. He's still enjoying the book. I'm fairly sure. But he's just wondering, going, these aren't exactly the Thunderbolts issues that he had grown up on.
Yeah. It was definitely switching things up, that's for sure.
These aren't your daddy's Thunderbolts.
I don't think we mentioned who's doing the other track. Like, Zurcher is only doing, like, half of the issues. So they're bringing someone else in to do the other half.
To do the Counter-Earth penciling?
Yeah.
It's none other than Chris Bautista, right?
It is. So I think it's a good pair of artists. Like, I don't know if I was familiar, but, you know, no slouch.
So what do we do next, guys? Do we read the Hawkeye issues? Do we just alternate? How do we wrap our heads around this?
Well, isn't there five and five, so...
Can we? Can we do five Hawkeye issues and then five Counter-Earth issues or vice versa?
Whoa. That's a lot of issues.
Let's see if we can get back here again before time for next episode, or the episode after at least, while we're still thinking about it.
All right.
Doesn't get lost in the ether. We're almost there. We're almost to 75. That's what I want to get to.
You think that helped kill the book at all? Like, if... Like, I know sales weren't the greatest, and you put a book on bi-monthly, and some people would just jump ship going, well, like, it's still good stories, but I just wonder if that has any effect on the book, or if new Marvel has more of an effect.
That's what I think is more of a thing. They were changing a lot of things up, and who wrote the, when they got back to Thunderbolts on the march to issue 100, who wrote those issues? Did Nicienza come back? Those issues?
I think he wrote the new Thunderbolts, but if I'm not mistaken, wasn't it... why do I want to say Busick did the Avengers Thunderbolts crossover?
Yeah, that might be the case,
Maybe a co-writer?
Because I'm wondering if, you know, personnel... if Nicienza's story was done and he was going off and doing other stuff or working for other companies, then that could facilitate a change in the title's status quo, too, you know?
Well, I think he's not getting... any work at Marvel after Thunderbolts, right? Doesn't his work dry up around...
I would think so.
Yeah.
Because the X-Men stuff has dried up around now, too.
Yeah. He does a Hawkeye book, like, a few years after.
You know, this is Quintana and Jimus time, so we've got Grant Morrison over on the X-book.
Yeah. But for Marvel, it's a fun and exciting time of new and experimental stuff, so.
There was some real good stuff that came out of it, but they also, in there, trying to discover other avenues and ways of presenting characters, they burned a lot of bridges, and they turned their backs on a lot of longtime creators who have nothing but love for a lot of these characters. And they really shut the door on a lot of people, whether it was the Stearns or the Burns, Starlin, all these guys. And the Burns. Yeah. But honestly, Nicienza probably among them. But things weren't good for long time creators. The Sal Buscema, I mean, the older guys, things definitely were different.
Yeah. You know, it's funny that the comics were pretty expensive for me in that experimental era, and I kind of feel like Marvel has a more diversity, like, currently with their lineup, and like, comics are expensive again. Like, it's weird.
Yep.
They are no joking on that, but I don't know, 30,000, it's okay. Like I said, it was pegging around the 60s. If I remember, I'll check the Comicron numbers at the end of that experiment and see. Because like most titles, it was having a slow attrition, but we'll see
I think 30,000 is fine. Like, you would totally keep a book going at that. Like, you have to reach like 20,000 and below before they would consider offing you.
And books also depend on how much it costs to make them, too. How much was Nicienza at this time? Was he up for a contract renewal and they were playing hardball? I know at some point Zirker went over and worked on some Iron Man stuff, too, if I'm not mistaken. So, you know, he might have been too hot a property to be using on this stuff. I don't know.
Well, they bring in Grummet in the future.
I can't wait for that.
Yeah, and that's like another one of those guys that fits into one of those types of books.
Well, hopefully you've enjoyed our trip into Thunderbolt Land, and join us again soon for Marvel's Most Wanted. Justice like light.
Later.
Back again with Kevin and Andrew, dragging them along, kicking and screaming, because with me waiting on reading the all new, all different Marvel number ones, although, like I've said, I very much enjoyed listening to you guys talk about those number one issues. It didn't ruin anything for me, but I just want to finish reading Secret Wars in its chronological order and get to the end of that story before I delve into the new number ones. And what's helping me do that is the fact that I do have all of these books kind of on my to-read pile that are still left over from, you know, recent eras in Marvel publishing, and it's given me an opportunity to get to some of those, which has been a lot of fun. I'm, like, getting closure on the old Marvel Universe, you know, guys?
Yeah, that was an interesting book, how it sort of fractured the different creative teams.
Well, that was one of the issues, the titles I went back and finished off was reading Amazing X-Men. And I just want to quick mention what the finale arc of that title was, which was issues 15 through 19. And Amazing X-Men was the Jason Aaron started book, written book, and it brought Nightcrawler back from the dead, right? After he died in one of those Messiah War Complex books. Right, didn't he? Isn't that when he died?
It does sound compliant. Didn't he die fetching the cure to something? Or going to hell? Or wait,
something.
I don't know. I read the one where he came back.
Yeah, that was the beginning of Amazing X-Men, where they bring him back from heaven with the demons and all that.
And he had to go fight pirates or something, right?
Yeah, well, the whole intention of the book was for Aaron to stay on it writing, and it to be Nightcrawler-centric, but Aaron got some opportunities to do some creator-owned stuff, and he was still doing Thor for Marvel, and he basically had to leave Amazing X-Men. Plus, there was this Nightcrawler book, Claremont-written Nightcrawler series that was going to pop up, 12 issues. Stay tuned, True Believers. I'm going to touch upon that as well.
Well, that's the one I was thinking of, too.
Yeah.
I remember, and it had Todd Knock. Was he the artist on
it? Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep.
And so the creative teams kind of bounced around for this 19-issue series, what turned out to be 19 issues, Amazing X-Men. And this final arc boasted Colossus and the Juggernaut, which we know they've had a relationship. And the arc starts off with Peter Rasputin, Colossus. He has a dream that Sidorak, the... what would you call him? A cosmic entity, nether demon that Doctor Strange invokes to use the crimson bands of Sidorak, right? Well,
yeah, I'm reading a lot of Doctor Strange right now, so he's always shouting, "By the crimson bands!" And I'm like, oh, here we go, Juggernaut again.
Yep, and so we know that Sidorak also had a gem that empowered the Juggernaut that Kane Marco used to wield, and then Colossus had for a little while as well. But Sidorak's gem has remanifested on Earth, and it's got a tradition of popping up in a Southeast Asian temple, which it's done again, and that's how it was found originally by Kane Marco. So the X-Men, they rush off to secure it, but Storm won't let Colossus come along, because he's got a history with the Juggernaut, being the Juggernaut, that whole bit. So the
bar fights.
The team, yeah. The team is Storm, Rockslide, from the new X-Men, Rachel Summers, Northstar, Nightcrawler, Firestar, and Iceman.
Yeah, that was the other cool thing about Amazing X-Men. You got to see some, like, almost some Spider-Man and his amazing friends
exactly.
Sort of action going on.
Two-thirds. You got to see the amazing friends for Amazing X-Men. Hey. Well, there are some others that the crystal calls to, the crystal of Sidorak, like Jin, this genie guy, and Maneater from the Thunderbolts, right?
Oh, yeah, that was pretty neat.
Also, nice tie-in. Way to loop that around, Steve.
Also, out of nowhere, Crossbones is after the gem, too, and fights Firestar a couple of times. He fights her. Then, also, Kane Marco, the original Juggernaut, he uses the Vanisher to bring him onto the scene, and then the Vanisher gets the heck out of there.
Well, he had a kind of a bad relationship with that X-Force Murder Squad team.
But he's still wearing the costume. It's funny. I think it helps him not vanish all the time. But you know who ends up coming up with the gem, though? Everyone's vying for it. Colossus, even Colossus shows up when he wasn't supposed to be there. He uses Pixie to get him there. Who comes up with it is Ahmet Abdal. You know who that is?
Oh, the living monolith?
The living monolith. But now he's the living monolith all juggernautized. He's this giant living monolith juggernaut marching through the Southeast Asian jungle.
Oh, he's going to make them all wear Egyptian clothes and build pyramids all day, isn't he?
If he has his way. But the first half of issue 18, it's all discussion. It's like the team just sitting around going, oh, great. Like, what are we supposed to do about this guy? And they sit around and they jab at each other verbally, and they talk about old times, and there's some really actually great character moments in the first half of this issue. No one wants to engage the giant at all, which really ticks him off. He's like, hey, come on, guys. Like, you know, I'm here, I'm giant, you know, who's going to stop me? Somebody should at least try, right? Well, they eventually do. But Colossus has a plan where he and Kane Marco use Pixie and Rachel Summers to go to Sidorak's dimension and appeal to him directly. And they appeal to him to depower the monolith and empower Colossus, that he'll take on the burden.
And all right, Colossus can have an awesome beard again.
How much of a burden is this thing? It seems like it's pretty cool.
Well,
nothing can stop you.
It made him all aggressive, like getting shot up with steroids kind of thing. And Sidorak agrees. He depowers the monolith, much to his chagrin, which is also a funny sequence. But it's not Colossus who he re-empowers. It's Kane Marco.
Oh, no.
But he's now like the uber juggernaut. He's got all these tubes coming out of his head that go into his back, but you can slice him and you can pull him out and it doesn't matter. So I don't know why they're there other than to make you want to pull him out to see if that stops him.
Is he a ride-sharing service too, Steve?
Do you remember the old way to beat the Juggernaut of you got to get his helmet off so that you can Professor X can zap him, right?
Yeah, that always worked.
No, you pull his helmet off and he looks like an alien now under there. And he's completely impervious to mental assaults. Every weakness he had has been removed now as Sidorak has, like, really remade him. He's no longer human. His face is all changed. It's crazy. So Colossus ends up to be the only one left to fight him at the end. And he ends up... Well, he ends up stopping him, not fighting him. Let's put it that way. And it has a very stern, Spidey-ish type solution to how the issue ends. But I thought it was a cool arc written by Chris Yost and drawn by George or Jorge Fornes.
Wait, so stern-like ending? Does that mean that he runs for president?
Oh. Stern, Spidey-ish ending, like that great Spider-Man Nothing Can Stop the Juggernaut two-parter where the Juggernaut's after Madame Web and Spider-Man's not going to defeat the Juggernaut, but he can figure out a way to manipulate the environment around him enough in a way to stop him. And
I think that was also early 90s X-Men cartoon type of solution, too.
Sure. But hey, the Living Monolith, come on now. That's a great callback to the old, Havoc was always having to deal with the Living Monolith back in the day, back in Roy Thomas, Neil Adams era. And then there was that crossover with Power Man and Iron Fist where the X-Men were in it, and Power Man and Iron Fist running around town trying to stop the Living Monolith. Come on, that's great stuff. The Living Monolith, all Juggernaut-ized. A fun callback.
I do remember the cartoon. Nothing can stop the Juggernaut. Roar.
Unless he loses momentum, as Dan has reminded me.
Yeah. Well, what you need is an Australian-sounding Wolverine.
Or a hill.
That's right.
A big hill. That'll slow him down.
The ocean won't slow him down. I love that one where he just walks through the bottom of the
ocean. It might take several months, though.
Hey, it's Steve Raker, back in the comic book bunker. I sent the boys home, but I wanted to stick around to tell you about one more series that I took an opportunity to read, and that's the Nightcrawler series from the 2014-2015, written by Chris Claremont with art by Todd Knock. Nightcrawler here is, you know, he's back from the dead thanks to his return in Jason Aaron written Amazing X-Men series, at least the first arc there. And he is also now associated with the Bamfs, those little pixie-like versions of himself that were introduced and sort of part of Nightcrawler's presence around the Jean Grey school over in the also Jason Aaron written Wolverine and the X-Men series. And I'm sitting here in the comic book bunker, my 11-year-old is happily playing along with Legos. You have any opinions on Nightcrawler? What do you think on Nightcrawler, Kevin?
I think he's pretty cool. He's one of my favorite X-Men, actually. I like how he can teleport and stuff. Not many superheroes really have teleporting powers. But I also like how he's like ninja-like and he uses swords and things. So overall, I think he's pretty cool.
Do you know that when he teleports, it's called bamfing?
No, I didn't know that, actually.
Do you know that it leaves a stink, like a sulfur smell?
No, I didn't know that.
There you go. That's your fun fact for the day.
Hi.
Two for the price of one. Well, in the Nightcrawler series, which ran for 12 issues, kind of ended up with four distinct storylines. The first four issues having Kurt Wagner, our Nightcrawler alias. Kurt comes to the Jean Grey School in the first issue. And we're also introduced to Rico, who is a crab-shelled, scorpion-like mutant student there, who we will see more of. And there's a, like, danger room training with Wolverine. And it becomes a catalyst for the tone of the book being set. It's nostalgic for looking back at the old days. I think in almost every issue there's a flashback sequence to a time that longtime readers of X-Men lore will remember. And also in the first issue, Kurt reunites with Amanda Sefton. And there's that funny Paul Smith panel homage with him and the stuffed animal on the couch. But a villain called, it's kind of a robotic, big hulking villain called Tri-Mega, attacks Amanda Sefton in her home. And Kurt and the Bamps help fend him off. The second issue, they go check on Margalai Sardos, the sorceress, their stepmother, and one of my favorite characters related to old X-Men lore, because it's one of my favorite X-Men stories, as I've not been shy in saying, and even joined Jerry McDade and Sean Pigeon over on their Great Expectations podcast, talking about that Nightcrawler's Inferno X-Men annual, X-Men Annual 4, I want to say it is, but that's always been one of my favorites, where they go to hell, and it's like Dante's Inferno and everything, but it's all Nightcrawler-related, and we get... the villain of the piece was Margalai Sardos. So here we are with her rammed horns and everything. And they get their reunion because Margalai thought that, Nightcrawler was dead. He's back, so he's been able to go around and have those character moments, and Claremont handles them quite well. But Tri-Mega does attack. They were right to go see if Margalai was safe or not. And Tri-Mega also lives up to his namesake, and we see where the Tri comes from. All of a sudden, you're not dealing with just one of him. Margalai ends up saving the day, though. And as a result, Kurt brings Margalai and Amanda to the Jean Grey School for protection. But the X-Men end up being betrayed by both of them. And it happens just before an army of Tri-Megas attack the school grounds. Funny, especially since Claremont knows Krakoa from using, its use. He wasn't involved. He came on the book afterwards, but in Krakoa's use in launching the all-new Uncanny X-Men way back in the day. But there was no sign or mention of Krakoa's offspring being on or a part of the school grounds. Which would have made for a cool defense scene, because I think the Krakoa would have handled the Tri-Mega's attack quite effectively, since it was a all-ground assault. In the fourth issue, Margalai assaults Storm and the Beast in a weird way, turning them into like these stacks of pages, which is all their memories, and uses that method of having them being sort of open books to steal their knowledge of the path to heaven that they took when they rescued Nightcrawler over an Amazing X-Men. This leaves them a couple of pages short of being complete, though, so it's quite a challenge for Amanda to put them back together. But she does so. But Margalai is enacting now her plan, which is a siege of heaven, trying to get some of that, divine power. Nightcrawler and Amanda Sefton do stop her, but Amanda ultimately sacrifices herself on one side of, like, the two-heaven dimensional barrier, and Kurt can't penetrate it because he gave up heaven, and he can't go back. But Kurt is left with having won the day, but having lost his heart. Wah, wah. In the fifth issue, the 5 and 6 is kind of a two-part storyline. Kurt accepts the new status quo. He's looking back at the past and remembering the old baseball games, with Kitty and Colossus and the rest of the gang. But now he is an instructor at the school, rather than being the misfit. He's got the Bamps surrounding him, helping him tie his tie and stuff. He also gets to hang out with Rachel Summers some, and they get to reminisce about Excalibur, which is also nice and nostalgic. Rico, the Scorpion Kid, ends up being in Nightcrawler's class, and not really knowing what to do with them, he takes them to the Danger Room, and they get a lot of action and acrobatic and gymnastic-type training, along with Nightcrawler sharing his wisdom with them. And the training really reveals a lot of the kids' shortcomings, particularly Rico. Then we get the Crimson Pirates showing up. Now, Most notably among them is their red-skinned, veiny, armored leader, Killian, and the silver jumpsuit-wearing, sword-carrying Bloody Bess. And we last saw them, they're a band of interdimensional pirates. I think we first and last saw them, actually, like 15 years ago, during who other than Chris Claremont's, one of his return stints on Uncanny X-Men, in the year 2000. I think they were in a couple issues around 384. And the pirates, they're being hired by an interdimensional mobster type who runs a slave ring, Tullamore Vogue. And he also had his first and last appearance during those Claremont issues. Storm, who's now the headmistress of the Jean Grey School, gives Nightcrawler a gift of the old X-Men Blackbird jet. And he works on it at night, kind of like it's an old jalopy, and gets it shined and ready to go. And during one such time when he's putting final touches on it late at night, he's come upon by Rico, who couldn't sleep, and they talk and they bond some, mostly over the whole totally freaky appearance thing that they share. And Kurt decides to take Rico along for a test flight of the Blackbird, which Rico totally gigs. He always wanted to be like a pilot or an astronaut or something, but knows that with his shelled mutant appearance that he would never be taken seriously or get those opportunities. While they're in the air, though, Storm buzzes in with like an emergency broadcast asking them to investigate a nearby mutant presence. But it turns out it's the same target that the Crimson Pirates are after for Vogue. It's this adolescent mutant girl named Ziggy Karst. Karst with a K. In issue 6, Kurt and Rico and the pirates all clash on site, and Rico, in the fracas, he mans up. He rescues other humans, he's like fighting and inhibiting his fear and being effective. Kurt also spends a lot of time sparring with Bloody Bess. I remember Nightcrawler from way back in Dave Cockrum, the artist, his iteration of Nightcrawler is he's all Errol Flynn, right? He's got these, he's very much a swashbuckler. And in his sparring and his repartee with Bloody Bess, there's like a little flirtatious energy going on between them too. In the end, Rico saves Ziggy from the pirates, but then Nightcrawler saves them all, and they take the fight to Vogue and give him an ultimatum that he can't, get around. And they end up getting free, but making a big enemy in the process. Issue 7 is a standalone issue where Nightcrawler dwells on the death of his longtime friend and teammate, Wolverine, from the whole Death of Wolverine event stunt thing. I mean, it makes sense. Wolverine had that poignant issue where he dealt with Nightcrawler's death, so it seems fitting that they'd sort of try to do the same with the chemistry reversed. Or equation, for that matter. Issues 8 through 12 wrap up the series with what is basically a sequel to the Crimson Pirates' Tullamore Vogue storyline. In the first three issues, Kurt is summoned telepathically by a desperate-for-her-life Bloody Bess. And so he and the Bamps teleport to her, and she's being chased by her other teammates, the Crimson Pirates. They're all possessed and after her. Chris Claremont, X-Men, possessions. If it ain't Dracula, it's got to be the Shadow King, right? Well, Storm, Psylocke, Colossus, Beast, Iceman, and Rachel pursue and join in on the fracas. And, of course, Rico and Ziggy following the Blackbird, although they're told not to. The whole thing ends up a possession mess. It's like possessed Bamfs, possessed X-Men, possessed pirates, etc. The whole ordeal really brings Kurt and Bess closer together, too. They grow fond of each other to the point of even sharing a kiss. There's also this cool sequence with Nightcrawler being jacked up by Bess and Psylocke and facing the Shadow King on the psychic plane. Oh, and the rest of the Crimson Pirates? They escape, making off, but also kidnapping Rico and Ziggy on the way. That leads us to the last two issues of Nightcrawler, issues 11 and 12, where Nightcrawler, the Bamfs, and Bess go after the pirates, kids, and Tullamore Vogue. Vogue's racket is a slave market, and what he's doing here is auctioning off kidnapped mutant children and adolescents. He's got a ton of them. And this is to be Rico and Ziggy's fate, especially after a hologram visual device displays an image of them, like in their adulthood, as they're expected to mature, looking highly effective and cool. Well, Rico and Ziggy, they're X-Men. They manage to escape, and they're, like, running loose within Vogue's Citadel. Vogue blames the Crimson Pirates for just not being able to keep tabs on these guys and losing them now twice. And he has them taken out and sold off as slaves themselves. Then Vogue hires some new hunter-gatherers. Another blast from Claremont's ex-past. The Warwolves from the Excalibur days. Kurt and Bess reunite with Rico and Ziggy, and they deal with trying to escape while fending off Vogue's spiked soldier, like, attack dog types, and these more fierce Warwolves. And then there's Rico, who keeps reminding everyone that escaping isn't enough. The other kidnapped kids need to be freed, and Vogue needs to be taken down. They're just turning their backs on them if they do anything less. This is a tall order for an elf, Bloody Bess, the Bamfs, a kid Scorpion, and Ziggy, but that's the challenge before them. The stakes, the drama, it's high, but the arc and the series really as a whole wrap up plenty satisfactorily. It's really worth a read. Check out Nightcrawler. Okay, gang, that's what I've been reading of late. Tune in next episode for more Marvel noise, just how you like it. In the meantime, you can find us on Facebook, on Twitter, at Marvel Noise, or I'm at Steve Raker. And you can hear us over on the Indie Comic Book Noise podcast, talking about our recent indie reads. So, until Nightcrawler has his Bamf bamfed by his Bamfs, make mine Marvel. Later.